Right now, it's time for Frank Ostaseski. Frank, first thing I got to ask you before we get into your life and your story and why you do what you do is that how you pronounce your name?
Yeah, you did really well, Drew. It took me years to learn how to pronounce that name.
What is that? Where's that from?
Polish. It's my father's side of the family, Poland, out of Krakow, and my mother's with Irish. So you can also pronounce it Ostaseski.
Ostaseski. Okay.
No, it's fine.
What is an end-of-life care pioneer?
Well, he doesn't ride on a stagecoach. That we can say for sure. I think what we can really talk about is that, you know, when I started out in this work, it's not that people were just beginning to die, but we were really beginning to look at contemplative approaches to the way in which we care for people who are dying.
All right. So a contemplative approach to the way someone is dying. Again, as an outsider, and I use that term lightly because I guess this might sound a little arrogant or a little non-Canadian, but as someone who grew up in the funeral industry, as someone who is a hospital chaplain, I've had a fair bit of experience with death. But somebody who really hasn't had that much experience with death doesn't know what the heck you're talking about. So does that mean you just, you know, walk into a room of someone who's dying and light candles and say a prayer with them and just kind of help them chill out before they die?
Well, you know, I think I don't think so. But I think that mostly in our culture, in the West at least, we tend to treat dying as predominantly a medical event. That engages us in the business of dying, the medicine of dying, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And while that's important and necessary, we should have the best symptom control and pain management we can muster. It's not enough. The medical model, while brilliant, is not big enough to embrace the profundity of what happens in the dying process. And so we have to reach outside that model. And I don't think there's a religious model that necessarily embraces dying in its fullness either. So I think we have to really look and see a lot of different ways of coming at this issue. But suppose we thought of dying as a transformative event rather than a failure. Then it might be that some of the greatest growth that we do in our lifetime happens in and around the time of dying.
All right, I got to read some of your bio here, and we've got some stop points. Death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us. Now, if we just stopped there and got all reflective about that, how would that actually change the way we live?
Well, you know, Drew, I was with a group of people from Silicon Valley a little while ago having a dinner, and I said something like, you know, death is inevitable. And a guy immediately raised his hand and he said, hey, you know, we're working on that, you know? And I said, great, that's terrific. I'm glad you're working on it. There are people working on extending life. I said, let's take the word death out of the sentence. Let's just look at endings. Let's look at the way we meet endings. The way the end of a sentence, the end of a relationship, the end of a meal, the way we end our day. You know, the way we meet an ending tends to shape the way the next thing begins. So I think a reflection on endings, or reflection on death, if you will, causes us to enter our life more fully, more completely, and to recognize what matters most.
That's incredible stuff. Okay, so your journey, I mean, you didn't... I know people enough to know that you haven't always been like this. What are the two or three things in your world, in your journey, that shaped you into who you are right now? I mean, you talk about, you know, sort of running towards death or running towards the things that you are afraid of or that we are afraid of. Have you had great tragedy and, I don't know, drama in your life, Frank?
Well... You know, I think that all of us have our degree of pain and suffering, yeah? And most of us, maybe if you were like me, spend a lot of time trying to avoid it. I did everything impossible to avoid my pain, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But it doesn't work. At some juncture, you have to turn toward this experience, toward what hurts, and see what you can learn about it. And when we do that, I think it becomes the ground for compassion and enables us to have an empathetic, build an empathetic bridge, rather, to those other people that might be suffering. So, yeah, I had my own share of suffering in my life. And but what I found it to be is a real deep gift now that allows me to touch other people's pain with less fear and pity and more compassion.
Which came first, your attraction to death or Buddhism?
I think that Buddhism, with its emphasis on impermanence and the moment-to-moment, the rising and passing of every possible experience, was a very early and very important influence in my life, you know. Within that practice, facing death is considered fundamental, you know. It can mature wisdom and compassion. It can strengthen our commitment to awakening. I think death in the Buddhist tradition is seen as a final stage of growth. And so daily practices of mindfulness and compassion were helpful to me, not only in addressing my own confusion and pain and suffering, but also in developing some discernment and wisdom in how to move through this life.
Frank Ostasevsky is an internationally respected Buddhist teacher and visionary co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project and founder of the Metta Institute. He has lectured at Harvard Medical School, the Mayo Clinic, Wisdom 2.0. I think that's maybe where I first really kind of hooked into what you're all about. And teaches at major spiritual centers around the globe. Frank is the 2018 recipient of the prestigious Humanities Award from the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. His groundbreaking work has been featured on Bill Maher's PBS series On Our Own Terms, highlighted on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and honored by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The website is fiveinvitations.com, fiveinvitations.com. Before we get into the specifics of these five invitations, Frank, having been at the bedside of many who have died, but nowhere near as many as you have been, you know, for you to walk into that room, I share this a lot, and I'm sure you'll understand this. C.S. Lewis would talk about what the Celts talked a lot about, which was that the world has thin places, various thin places around the world, a place where the gap between the creator and the created gets really, really thin. And for me, Frank, the thinnest place was not Stonehenge or, you know, all these various, I was on the Camino a year and a half, whatever ago. The thinnest place I've ever been in has been the hospital room of somebody who's dying. And yet, it sounds like we're sort of painting this as some kind of kumbaya Walt Disney moment. The reality is, not everyone, and it's rare in my experience anyway, not everyone gets to pass with peace. There is some horrific, I have witnessed some horrific endings to people's lives. How do you get all kumbaya about those moments? How do you train the clinicians or the chaplains to lean into those horrific scenes?
Well, first of all, I just want to agree with you about the veils getting very thin at certain times of our life or in certain places. I mean, birth is one of them, where we also see that kind of thinning of the veils, if you will. Death is certainly one. You know, I'm not kumbaya about dying. I'm not romantic about dying. I think it's hard work. I think it might be the hardest work you'll ever do in your life. And it doesn't always turn out well, and there's not a red ribbon on the box. I think it can be sad and cruel and messy and beautiful and mysterious. But most of all, it's normal, Drew. We all go through it. None of us get out of here alive, you know? And so I think that the way in which I train people is to try to become somewhat mindful or attentive, we could say, to what's actually happening as it's happening and not get swept away in our ideals about how this dying should be going, you know? The idea of a good death, which is promulgated a lot in our culture, you know, I think this is a dangerous term in a certain way. I think we put a tremendous amount of pressure on people in their dying process to do it in a way that that suits our particular hope of outcome, you know. Dying is already hard enough without loading a whole lot of other stuff on top of it. So I don't know how people should die. My job is to companion them through the process in the best way that I possibly can. And for them to do it in a way that really suits them, you know. It's not my dying, it's their dying.
Well said. Frank, I've had discussions with people in the funeral industry as well as some chaplains I know about, you know, funeral services versus celebration of life services. I guess I wanted to know your commentary on that. Some I've spoken to have said, well, the celebration of life service, I get that, but it's almost like we're ignoring the reality of death. In the celebration of, it's almost like we're putting our fingers in our ears and going, la, 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 la. And whereas the other side is this macabre sort of, you know, March of the Goblins kind of vibe when it comes to many funeral services. What are your thoughts on those two, I guess, angles?
Well, I might take a slightly different turn on it, which is I want to make a distinction between what we might normally think of as ceremony and what we might think of as ritual. And in our culture, as we've stepped away from religion and certain practices, we've lost our familiarity with ritual. We've all been to a lot of ceremonies that felt very impersonal. They were mechanical in some way. Mm-hmm. What ritual does is it makes the truth that's already in the room present. Yeah. And it has personal relevance for the people involved. And when it does that, then it can have a really transformative effect on the people that are engaged. So here's an example. I was in Germany teaching there and working with an ex-Catholic priest who ran a hospice there. And when the whenever somebody would die, he'd call the local priest who would come and do the last rites. But eventually this priest got tired of coming to this hospice because people were dying practically every day. And so he said, you come up with something. And so this ex-priest came up with a very simple idea. When people were dying, before they died, he went through and he anointed them, Drew. He went, he touched their forehead with a bit of oil, and he said, you know, may your mind be clear on this journey, and their arms. May your arms be able to embrace whatever you come into contact with. May your legs be strong to carry you through. And he went through this whole, went through the whole body of this person, and oftentimes family members were there to kind of acknowledge that this dying was happening, and to do it in a ritual-like way that allowed everybody to see more than the wasting away that we often talk about in the dying process, to really see this as a the possibility of a transformation here, not only for the person that's dying, but for all those people that were accompanying them.
So interesting.
So
interesting.
Yes. So there's a way of kind of incorporating both in a way, you know?
Yeah. No, I like that. Frank, in your experience, has religion been a help or a hindrance when it comes to dying?
Well, of course, you know, just as we were saying earlier, every birth is completely unique. Every experience of dying is totally unique, too. There's no one way to go through it, no one right way, even though some religious traditions would have us believe that. I think there's a difference between belief and faith. You know, I've seen a lot of people come to their dying with a lot of beliefs, and beliefs are, in a way, strongly held ideas. And when those beliefs are challenged by the dying process, which is they will inevitably be challenged, oftentimes people feel abandoned when their beliefs are, in some ways, evaporate or go out the window at the time of dying. Those people that have faith, or and not necessarily faith in some external power, but in their ability to meet the situation, no matter what arises, those people who have looked more deeply into the human experience tend to have an easier time with the process of dying. Not always, but frequently. So if we have already in our lives a willingness to look at what it means to be human, to look deeply into that, then we meet the dying process in a similar way. I mean, the habits of our life have a very strong momentum, you know, and they follow or propel us, rather, right through into the time of dying. So the question that arises is, what habits do we want to create? Yeah.
Frank, I don't even know if I should go here or not. Let me... You know, it's never really stopped me before.
Ever.
How do you want to die?
Oh, boy. That's a question that people ask me a lot. And sometimes I hesitate to answer because I don't want to set up some kind of model about how it should go.
No, exactly.
For anyone.
No, I get right. that. Yep.
So, you know, my great wish, my hope is that I could be awake in the dying, in my dying process. It's not an experience I want to sleep through. You know, so that's the first thing. And the second is that I would be able to be attentive to those people who are caring for me or are with me and could express my gratitude and appreciation for them. But here's the thing, Drew, I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea what the conditions are going to be in the time of my dying. And so trying to just conjure up exactly the right, you know, sense of, you know, it's like being a wedding coordinator. You know, I don't get to do that.
Yeah.
Dying is bigger than me. So my deepest hope, of course, is that I can have a kind of capacity to meet whatever conditions come my way. Yeah. Huh. And to meet that with some degree of grace and humility and hopefully some wisdom and compassion.
So I'm really good at saying dopey things. So let me exercise my gift. You have a perfect Buddhist voice. Right, Tim?
Totally.
Does he not? Like, if I was to run across my first Buddhist, This is what I'd want him to sound like.
Or to be speaking in the background of my massage.
Okay, that just got weird.
No, you know that calm, soothing voice.
So, I'm the question.
One. Yes, I'm not quite sure how to formulate this question, so I'm just going to ask it anyway. Your job is to accompany people through the process, as you said, the journey. Obviously, there's two sides to that. There's the person who is passing away and those who are observing it. Do you run into conflict between how people want the journey to go, and how do you work with that? You know, one wants the celebration of life service, one doesn't. That kind of thing.
Okay.
How do you resolve
that? All right.
Okay, so let's go back to what I think maybe you're picking up on with my voice, and I don't think it's just in the voice, but I think, you know, in the chaos of illness, you know, one calm person in the room can make all the difference.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I try to be that calm person, and I don't think that's particularly special. I think all of us have that capacity, you know. Like, you know, when someone's sick, you know, we lend them the strength of our back and our legs to move them from the bed to the commode or to the wheelchair, you know. We lend them our bodies. I think we can also lend people the concentration of our minds and the fearlessness in our hearts. I think we can be a reminder of stability and confidence, you know. And, you know, we can be, in that way, a compassionate refuge for people. We can be a presence that restores trust and encourages the patient to open in a similar way to their own experience. So that's the first thing. And the second is that, you know, yes, there's always confusion in the room. You know, when someone's dying and the family's there or the friends are there, everybody that they've ever known who died is also there in the room. And I don't mean in a California woo-woo way. I mean that the memory of all the deaths that they've seen are in the room.
Yeah.
And so the expectations that are formed around those deaths are also in the room. And so that has to be dealt with. There's no one way that people go through this dying process, of course. So just day before yesterday, I was with a family. The father was dying, great guy, longtime Zen practitioner, actually. And his son, he was restless. And his son kept saying, I keep waiting for the transcendent moment. Where is the transcendence? He's practiced all his life. How come he's restless? And I said, let's watch. You know, let's be still and watch. And so we repositioned the father in bed and got him a little calmer. And he sort of settled down a little bit. And I said, you know, you're going to watch this pulsing between a kind of chaos and a kind of calmness. Huh. And really, until this kind of pulsing is allowed to happen, it kind of shakes loose the ways, all the identities, all the roles that we've carried all our life. They all are stripped away by death, or they're gracefully given up, but they all go. And then we come down to something much more fundamental about who we actually are. Yeah. And I think that when we're patient enough in the room and we don't impose some idea on it, that frequently is the case, and people can see that. So I would sit with the son, you know, as we had a cup of coffee, and I'd say, look at him now. He's quite calm, isn't he? And I said, it's really important to mark the calmness just as much as you mark the agitation and the restlessness. Yeah. So I think there's lots of ways to be with people. And yes, people have different ideas about what should happen around the process of dying. And all of those have to be addressed. Yeah. They all have to be addressed. The dying person is not the most necessarily the most important person in the room. Everybody in the room is important.
So yeah. Well said.
Yeah, I think that was the question I was really going for. Who gets precedence sort of in this?
Yeah, Frank, I have found that the families, as well as those that are transitioning out, you know, whatever phrasing we want to use here, but
they
okay, that'll work, yeah. Thanks. But it's funny you say that, because in the context of what I'm about to say, I just failed miserably. They appreciate it when I'm really direct with them, when I don't skirt around the word dying like I just did with you. Have you found that?
Again, I think it's going to be dependent upon individuals and their, you know, the diversity of their upbringing, families, cultures, etc. I mean, for example, some years ago, I took care of a young man dying of AIDS who was Japanese. And he had not let his family know that he was a gay man, nor did he let him know that he was dying of AIDS. And he made me promise that I would not share that information with his family. And then his mother, after he died, a day or two later, his mother arrived. She wasn't able to be there at the time of his death. She flew from Japan. And we sat down in the room where her son had died. And she said, can you tell me how my son died? And I said, beautifully. And she began to weep. And she said, oh, that is such a reassurance for me. That's so kind of you to share that with me. Yeah. I didn't, she didn't need those particular sets of details. Yeah. We have an idea about informed consent in this culture, and it is important, of course, when we're choosing treatment plans. But sometimes it's not the most important thing. Mm-hmm. What was really important in this case was, between his mother and son, was the way in which he met this experience. Yeah. The way in which he met it.
Man, I could listen. I just called you dude. Sorry. I could listen to you forever.
Well, we don't have forever.
No, we don't. Well, let's move along here. We're on the line with Frank Ostaseski. He is an end-of-life care pioneer and the author of The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. The Five Invitations: Don't Wait, Welcome Everything, Push Away Nothing, Bring Your Whole Self to the Experience, Find a Place of Rest in the Middle of Things. Love that one. Cultivate Don't Know Mind. This is gold. Absolute gold. Can you pick two that you want to succinctly let our listeners in on and just kind of hook them into? I want people to get hooked into this book so bad. I want everyone to have this book on their shelf. Two of those you really want to dance with right now. Which ones?
Well, let's start with the first one. That's always the best place. You
okay.
Know? Well, let me just say that these invitations, if you will, they were tools, principles that we used in taking care of people at the end of life. But then we found out that they had a relevance for the rest of us in living a life of meaning and purpose and hopefully some degree of wisdom. Mm-hmm. So don't wait. That's the first one, right? You know, waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been with families when their loved one was dying and they would say to me, you know, when is mom going to die? And waiting for that moment of death, they missed all the moments in between. Yeah. So to don't wait, that's not to sort of, you know, live a life of a kind of urgency, actually, or you know, in some kind of panic. It's to really, it's really an encouragement to actually be in contact with our life right here, right now. Hmm. So, you know, when I'm with people who are dying, you know, the two questions that come up for them frequently is not, you know, did I get that? I should have gotten that second Mercedes or bought more crap. You know, that's not what's on their mind. It's not even about their regrets. People always imagine it's about that. It's really two questions are, am I loved and did I love well? Am I loved and did I love well? Now, if those are the two questions that are most important to us in and around the time of our dying, why wait to address those questions? Why not step into them now? I mean, to imagine that at the time of our death, we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime, this is a ridiculous gamble. Not one I encourage us to take, yeah? So don't wait. If there's people you love, tell them you love them now. If there's things that you really want to do with this life, you know, something you want to explore, get curious about it now. Don't wait, yeah?
So
that's
good.
The first one.
So good. And I set up a website for my dad for his 80th birthday. I think it's down now. We called it thankyougrant.com. And having grown up in the funeral business and presided over numerous funerals, you hear all these people paying tribute and honor to these people who have passed. It's like, why did we all wait until they passed to say this stuff? And I wanted people to say the kinds of things they would say to my dad at his funeral, but say it now. And I presented him with these printed off pages, because he doesn't know how to work the computer, printed off pages of things that people might say to my father at his funeral. So I love this. I love this. Okay, next one.
You pick one. Go ahead. You pick one.
Thank you. Oh, this is exciting. It's like being at Swish LA and picking the toy out of the treasure box at the end.
That's right.
Okay, well, look, find a place of rest in the middle of things. I mean, I've spoken a lot about the God of the highs. Ooh, everything is so amazing. Life is awesome. I just got a new job. Thank you, God. Or the God of the lows. I am in deep trouble right now. Dear God, where are you? But the God of the in-betweens is something that I don't think we quite grasp. And I think this is where the Buddhists can kind of come in and help us explore a little bit. And that's, I don't know, this is what I find very intriguing. Find a place of rest in the middle of things. Go for it, Frank.
Well, you know, most of us, if you're like me, you know, we think we'll find rest later, you know, like when we, you know, check off our to-do list, or we go on vacation, or we go on a Buddhist retreat of some kind. Hmm. Well, that's great, of course, but, you know, my list is never checked off. If I wait until the end of my, till my list gets checked off, I'll never rest. So I have to find a way of resting right in the middle of whatever it is I'm doing. Okay, so here's a story to illustrate that. I got called in one night to the bedside of someone who was dying. Her name was Adele. She was this ferocious 86-year-old Russian Jewish lady, tough as nails, you know? And when I arrived, she was sitting on the edge of the bed, her feet dangling off the end, you know, in her, you know, night clothes. And I went in and sat in the corner of the room because that's my way. Look and see. Is anything really needed before we jump in to help? And there was a really sweet attendant next to her. And the attendant said, turned to Adele, and she said, you know, you don't have to be frightened. We're right here with you. Adele was actively dying. And Adele turned back to her and she said, honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be scared. Just like that, you know? So I waited a little bit longer, and then the very sweet attendant said to her, you know, would you like a little shawl or a blanket around your shoulders? You look a little cold. And Adele shot back, of course I'm cold. I'm almost dead.
Love this.
Now, I hope I have half of the tenacity of this woman when I'm dying.
Yeah.
So I noticed two things there. One was that she was breathing with great difficulty. Every breath a struggle, every out breath a struggle. And this despite all the correct interventions, you know, morphine and oxygen, et cetera. There's a labor to dying, just like there's a labor to getting born sometimes, you know. So there was that labor. There was that struggle. And then there was this other exchange that she was having. And that told me that this woman didn't want to talk about tunnels of light or any of these things. She wanted straight talk. She wanted authentic relationship.
Nice.
So I pulled my chair up really close to her, and I looked her directly in the eyes, and I said, Adele, would you like to struggle a little bit less? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, I noticed something there. At the end of your, you know, exhale, before the next inhale, there was this little gap, this little pause. I wonder if you could put your attention there for a moment. Now, remember, this is an 86-year-old Russian Jewish lady. She doesn't care beans about Buddhism or meditation or any of these things. But she's highly motivated in this moment to be free of suffering, which is what gets most people to turn toward their spiritual practice in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I said, come on, I'll do it with you. So as she would breathe in, I would breathe in. If she would breathe out, I would breathe out. I didn't guide her. I didn't impose any idea. I just accompanied her. And then I noticed, you know, as we did this for several minutes, that her attention seemed to rest in that gap there, right? And the fear in her face just drained away, actually. You could see it in her face, Drew. And then she said, I think I'm gonna rest now. And she said, oh, I said, okay. And she leaned back in her pillow, and a short while later, she died very peacefully. I think Adele found the place of rest in the middle of things.
Yep.
You see, that all the everything was still happening. None of the conditions had changed. She was still dying. There was still difficulty with the breath. There was all of the, you know, certain amount of chaos in the room that was part of this experience. But right in the middle of that, she found a place of rest. Hmm. Now, where do we find it in our lives? You know, I mean, she found it in that gap between the inhale and the exhale. That's a place of fear or faith, you know. Do we trust the next breath will come, or are we terrified and start manipulating the breath in some way? So I think that each of us can do that. I think each of us can find a place of rest right in the middle of what we're doing. And we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is that we're engaged in, you know, whether that's being with our children or reading a book or walking down the street. Yeah.
So well said. So well said. All right. Look, just before we say goodbye, the Cultivate Don't Know Mind. I'm not sure. I didn't get to this part in the book, so I'm not exactly sure what this is all about. But from everything you've been saying, it seems like it's important for people who are going to walk others through this time of death to be a chameleon. Chaplains, be a chameleon. They need to be agendaless. And I think that helps to cultivate this don't know mind. Am I anywhere near what's correct here?
I think you're quite close, and you know you're close. I mean, chameleon, I think we have to be completely ourselves is what we have to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, not inauthentic. No, exactly. Sorry.
So don't know mind isn't limited by agendas. It's not full of expectations. It's not limited by our role even. It's free to discover, you know. When we're so filled with knowing, you know, when our minds are made up, it narrows our vision and it obscures our ability to see the whole picture, I think. So a wise person is both compassionate and humble, you know. Don't know mine is not knowing, you know. Or let me say it differently. Don't know mine is not ignorance. You know, ignorance is that we know something, but it's the wrong thing, and we keep insisting on it. There's a lot of that going on in the world right now, you know. So don't know mine is a mind that's open, that's receptive, that's curious, that's full of wonder, that wants to discover, you know. That's a don't know mind, and that can meet anything in a way. You know, it's not that our expertise and our tools, et cetera, aren't there to, you know, to help us and support us. But I don't lead with my tools. I lead with my humanity, right? And then I got my tools in my back pocket, and when I need one, I can reach out and get it. But first, lead with our humanity, you know?
Yeah.
Lead with your good heart and trust it to be a reliable guide in this work. Yeah.
So good. So good. Frank Ostaseski. He is an end-of-life care pioneer and the author of the book that we've been chatting about, The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. The website is fiveinvitations.com. You are off to Europe for a bit of time, is that right?
Tomorrow morning I fly to Italy to teach in Rome and Florence and Milan and all over there, Torino, all over. And then in England to teach there.
Do you need a Sherpa, a bodyguard or something? I don't know.
Sure, come on along. Okay. Yeah, come on along.
Frank.
Hey, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you as well. Take care. Enjoy your time.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. Frank Ostaseski on The Drew Marshall Show. You can learn a lot from this guy. He's just dropping nugget after nugget, you know? Ugh. It's like a rabbit trail.
Yes.
It's not maybe the best analogy ever.
No. You're good with those analogies today. You're leading with your heart, not your heart.